the way in modern Hebrew it would be translated as policeman. I don't know how they translate it. How do they translate it?
Policeman.
That's the closest thing to it, even though the word shoter really means guard. We'll see right away the meaning of it. It's a guard. Titein lecha, you shall appoint. Ve'ol she'arecha. She'arecha literally means your gates, but it's just a way of expressing the idea of a city. Every city has its own gate. Ve'ol she'arecha. Asher Hashem Elokecha noten lecha lishvatecha. According to your own pride. Ve'shaftu et ha'am. They should judge the nation mishpat tzedek. With justice, correctly. Now, here the commentary of Rashi says, what is a shofet? That's simple, that's the judge. The one, says Rashi, who makes halachic decisions. Right? You stole from him, you pay him. You owe him, you pay him. Right? That's the decision of the judge. What is the shofet? The shofter, according to Rashi, is the one that physically carries down the judgment passed by the court against a person. If he refuses to do it, that's what the shofter does. Now, the word for shofter is the one that guards the laws of the Torah, that physically makes sure that the laws of the Torah are fulfilled. But the commentaries ask that there is something odd about the construction of the verse. It should, what is the job of the shofet? The job of the shofet is to judge, right? The word says so. Shofet, mishpat, is to judge. The job of the shofet is to blindly follow the decision of the judges. So why would the Torah say you shall appoint judges and policemen or guards in all the cities that God gave you, and they shall judge the people correctly? If it only applies to the judges, why would the Torah say they should judge the people correctly? Right? It should say like this. Shoftim titein lecha, judges, that they should judge correctly, and shoterim, to carry out the judgment. Why would the Torah put them all together under one category? The judges of the people. How are the policemen the judges of the people? So one of the commentaries says like this, really, what the verse is telling you is an insight into the whole judicial system in Judaism. There are certain laws, for instance, that are clear-cut, but there is a certain flexibility that the Torah gives to the courts that goes beyond the letter of the law. Let me give you a simple example. There is a law, for instance, of indirect damage. It's called gromo, indirect damage. Means like this. What is a damage? A damage is I take a stone and I throw it and I break your window. That's a clear-cut damage. The judges say you are guilty, pay $100. Okay? But let's say the situation is not so simple. For instance, I didn't throw a stone and broke your window, but I put a lock on the door of your store, on the entrance of your store, that caused that many people should go to another store. You hear that? Which means I didn't directly damage you. Indirectly I damaged you. Or, there are thousands of cases of indirect damage, right? Let's say I put a sign in front of your window without your realizing it. Keep away, right? The man in this store is a thief or whatever. Indirectly I damaged. There are people who are not going to come in. So, what is the judgment in such a case in indirect damages? So the law is clear-cut. Grama benezakim patur, indirect damages, goes beyond the power of the court. You do not make him pay for indirect damages. You hear this case? The law is clear-cut. On the other hand, you have the following statement in the Talmud. However, the court has the responsibility to make sure that the person that caused the damage makes it up. Now, how does that make sense? On the one hand, the law is that you don't pay for indirect damages, right? On the other hand, right, it says, but the court has to make sure that such a thing doesn't happen. So he rectifies it, he pays a fine or whatever. So in the commentaries it says like this, because by us in Judaism, the judge has a double job. He's number one a judge, he makes halachic decisions, but he's also an educator. He's the teacher of the people, meaning the dayan, the judge, is also a rabbi, a teacher. So therefore, even though as a judge he has to say what the law of the Torah is, that indirect damages you don't pay, but on the other hand, as a teacher, right, who has to make sure that the society is trained correctly and he educates the people, he's the teacher. He has to make sure that such a thing doesn't happen again. If he lets him go free, if he doesn't have to pay, he may not be careful next time, right? So therefore, he has the power to make him pay, the damager. He makes the damager pay in order that such an action shouldn't be repeated, okay? So we have this double job, the job of judge and the job of teacher. Now, as a teacher, what is your job? To guard the Torah. Not to guard the people, to guard it, to make sure that the Torah is kept. If people are going to take the Torah law, the halakha, lightly, right? Obviously some people will abuse it. So therefore what it means is that the judge himself has a double job. He has a job of a judge, of making halachic decisions, but he also has the job of the policeman, meaning he has to make decisions that are going to guard the law. So this means that we are talking about the same person. According to this interpretation, when we say, you shall appoint judges that care about it, not that it's just a matter, it's just a scientific decision. The decision is patur, exempted, right? That's not the point. The point is you have to train people to be good. So even though legally he may be exempted, morally, he's obligated to pay. Therefore, he is at the same time a shofei and a shoter. Right? He's a policeman in a way. Now, the same person has a double job. Okay, so according to this interpretation, the first verse really means like this. When you're appointing a judge, don't just appoint a brilliant legal mind. That's not good enough. You have to appoint a judge that's also a guard of Torah. A person who takes the Torah seriously. It matters to him, right? And that person, right, has to make the judgment. So now it answers the question. Remember the original question we started with. How can the Torah say, Shoftim, you shall appoint judges, Veshotrim, you shall appoint policemen, and they should pass Mishpat Tzedek, a correct decision. The policeman doesn't have to pass any decision, he's not the judge, but according to this commentary, it clarifies it. We are talking about the same person. The same person is the policeman of the law. He cares, okay? He is the judge and he is the guard. That's a different story altogether, okay? So you can't just say that a person knows the legal aspect of Torah. A chacham. Chacham is not sufficient. You have to be a tzaddik. You have to be a righteous man. Because only a righteous man, we assume, really cares about the law. The chacham has an intellectual sense of the law. He doesn't have an emotional attachment to the law. The tzaddik, the righteous man, is both. Okay? So therefore, he has to be a chacham and a tzaddik. The chacham part makes them the shofei. The tzaddik part makes him the shoter. Okay, this is what the commentaries say. Now, of course, if you want to make a comparative study between the judicial system in Judaism as opposed to the secular world the way we know it, I mean, that's one basic difference. For instance, a judge would tell you, for instance, he's going to be confirmed for a certain position, right? A very high position in a very high court. So what will be judged? his legal background, his insights, his intelligence, his knowledge. What about how moral he is in his own personal life? He would say, well, that's none of your business what I do in my own private time. And in Judaism, there's no such a thing. I mean, it's the whole person, because you're not only a judge, you are the guard of Torah. You have to be worthy of it, right? So, of course, our attitude towards the judge is completely different. It's not only a judge, it's a teacher. Okay, now, the next verse, number 19, says like this. Lo ta'ate mishpat. Now, very difficult statement. Lo ta'ate mishpat. Literally, you shall not twist the law. How is it translated? Bend. You shall not bend the law. You shall not twist the law. What? Rest the law. Same idea. Right now, it's not straight. Not going straight in the law. So the commentaries here ask the obvious question. By definition, what is a shofet? In Hebrew, it's even clearer. The word shofet is very closely connected with mishpat. What is mishpat? The law. Right? If you go against the law, you are not a shofet. And how can the Torah say the judge is commanded not to judge incorrectly? I mean, that's the job of a judge. It's too obvious. Right? It's like saying the job of a human being is to be human. I mean, that's what a human being is. I mean, that's the job of the shofet, to take care of the mishpat. That's what makes him a shofet. To the extent that he doesn't follow the law, he's not a shofet. Right? This is one question, and then there is another question, and one question will really answer the other. The word tatek, lintot, note in Hebrew means to turn, right? Netiya is to turn, right? Why doesn't he say clearly? Don't decide incorrectly. Why say it in such a way? Don't turn the mishpat. Don't turn. Right? It's a very odd way of expressing a clear-cut idea. Don't decide incorrectly. In other words, A and B are having a case in front of a judge. Obviously, A is correct. He is right. The judge is not allowed to say B is right. If that's the case, why so say so? Do not judge incorrectly. Why express this idea in such an odd form? Lo tate netia. Don't twist, don't turn. What did you say? It says don't bend. Why is it called bending? That's called being wrong, not bending. So the commentary says that the Torah is not really warning you to judge correctly. Obviously, by definition, to be a judge is to judge correctly. Bending means something else completely. What does it mean, bending? Let's say, for instance, that you have a preconceived notion. Your preconceived notion. Your notion, for instance, tells you, your preconceived notion tells you that really we in society today, we give too much freedom to criminals, for instance. Just give a preconceived notion. And therefore we have to be tougher with them. Or it can be the other way around. We are too tough with them. We have to be more freer with them. We have to give them more freedom. We have a preconceived notion. Then a case comes in front of you. Right. And the case can go really either way. It's not a clear-cut case. It can really go either way. So now the question is, what do you do in a case that can go either way? It's not 100% clear. Right? Are you allowed to let your preconceived notion affect the case? We are not talking about a clear-cut case that one is right, black and white. We are talking about a case which is gray. It's not black and white. Are you allowed to let your preconceived notion affect your decision about this case? And that's a very fair question. It's a very fair question. Let's say you have a certain point of view. Like in this case, right? Like in this case. Let's say you belong to the... You're a member of the Supreme Court. In our case, comes to you, the criminal wasn't... the rights weren't read to him on the spot, right? So, you can say, yes, but definitely he's a murderer. He's definitely a danger to society, right? So you're going to say, well, obviously, I mean, you're not going to let a murderer run around free because the policeman forgot to read him the rights, for instance. But on the other hand, the man said, well, listen, I couldn't defend myself, right? Therefore, I admitted, and therefore, many things happened because I had no possibility to defend myself correctly. So now I have to wait. What should I do? Should I allow it or shouldn't I allow it? So the question is, do I judge the case? In other words, if the case says to me, but he is guilty, right? Do I have a right that my preconceived notions about society in general and about law in general should tip the scales of the case? Okay? That is what the warning of the Torah is. Even though you have correct preconceived notions, right? But the case is not clear enough to make a decision. Lo tate, don't turn, don't tip the scales in favor of one position because it fits your preconceived notion. This is what the Torah is warning you. In other words, judge the case. Don't apply your preconceived, your pre-accepted values, your prejudices to the case. Don't accept it. You have to judge the case in itself. If according to the halakha, he is guilty, so then say he's guilty. If according to the halakha, it's not enough to make him guilty, you can't tip the scales because of your preconceived notion. So now it answers both questions. First of all, our first question was, why would the Torah warn the judge, don't say a lie, don't say B is right when A is right? I mean, that's too obvious. I mean, the Torah wouldn't have to tell you that. I mean, you're not a judge, you're a liar. Right? The answer is, we're not talking about a clear-cut case. We are talking about a case that can go either way. It's not a black and white case at all. And then we ask the other question. Why does the Torah say, lo tate, don't turn, don't twist, right? Why not say clearly, don't say a lie, don't judge incorrectly? Because we're not talking about a case that is incorrect. It could be correct. Nobody can prove to you that's incorrect, right? It can go either way. You are just tipping the scale. That is what the Torah is warning you about. The very subtle cases. Don't let your preconceived notions, or... doesn't have to be preconceived notions. It can be a preconceived feeling towards the accused, right? He looks so innocent, right? So since the case is not clear anyway, the way he looks, or, you know, he seems so nice. Don't let that affect you at all. You have to judge the case on its own merit. That's what lo tate mishpat is. We are talking about a case that is not at all clear. Now, then it says like this, lo tate mishpat, lo takir panim. Now, before we go on to the lo takir panim, by the way, I mean, it's, you know that there are many judges in a, let's say in the United States judicial system, that you can more or less predict which way they are going to go, because they are conservative, they are liberal, right? I mean, obviously, the conservative will say this way, the liberal will say this way. That is a situation that the Torah would be against. It means, if your preconceived notions can make me guess which way you are going to go, that means that there is a lack of objectivity, right? Therefore, you are not worthy of being a judge. Meaning, if the case is judged, because that will be the situation. The case is judged by their preconceived notion. If I'm a conservative, right, automatically I'll tip the scales this way. So what kind of a judge am I? I'm not being a judge. I already decided before the case started. Okay? This is why That's another thing, another situation where the Jewish Jewish judicial system is completely different than the secular judicial system. Now, as you can understand, it was very common in Jewish law for judges say, "I don't know." You hardly ever find it in the secular system. The judges say, "You know what? It's too close to call. I just don't know." Usually, you don't have too many abstentions, right? That "I really don't know." They come up with their decisions. That's very suspicious. Because, I mean, there are so many cases, especially cases that go up to the Supreme Court. They are really so difficult. Right? How can it be that most of them know exactly what's right and what's wrong? In the Jewish courts, you know how the system was? You had, for instance, in the Supreme Court, you had 71 members. But really, every time they would sit in judgment, there would be many more than 71 members. And for instance, it says like this. They would sit according to a certain order. The more senior one, right, the one with most experience would sit first. And the last one, that could be the 150th, would be the last one. Now, the last one would be, which is the youngest one, the one with least experience, would be the one who say his opinion first. Why, said the Talmud? Because if the older one, the more experienced one, will say his opinion first, it will affect the judgment of everybody else. I naturally will decide that. Oh, if he says so, how can I say otherwise? So it would take away from my objectivity. So it has to start with the youngest one, the least experienced one. And then they go on and on and on and on. Each one who says, "Therefore, I don't know," he's removed. He removed from the case. A person who says, "I don't know," is removed from the case. And the next one says his opinion. So therefore, let's say, member number 69 said, "I don't know," so he's removed, and member number 70 comes into his place. He also says, "I don't know," so member number 71 comes into his place, and so on and so forth. In case you don't have 71 members saying an opinion, you have to bring more rabbis until you have 71 members, in the case of the Supreme Court, saying their opinion. And if you don't, you abolish the case. You say you couldn't come to a decision, and that's it. That's how careful they were about not being affected and not to have a preconceived notion. And also the other basic difference. The whole system of hiring your own lawyer is not accepted in Judaism. Who was the man's defender? Did you know? For instance, somebody's accused of murder. Right? Who defends it? One of the judges. At least one of the judges. Now, some of the judges, at least one of the judges, has to be convinced of his innocence. What about... What? No, the case starts with the person presenting his case in front of the 71, sometimes 23 judges. Let's say it was a lower court, 23 judges. So let's say 23 judges. And let's say that after presenting his case, all 23 members unanimously say, we find you guilty. Did you ever hear that the case is annulled? If all of them unanimously find them guilty, they say, too bad, we can't pass a judgment. Because there is no defense, exactly. Because no one is convinced of his defense. So he had no defense. You hear? He was so guilty that nobody could defend him. Therefore, he had no defense. Therefore, his rights were kept. Therefore, we can pass judgment. You hear? Kulo chayev, if a whole court decides that he's guilty, you don't pass the judgment of guilty. You hear this the law in the Talmud?
Yeah. Do they have to bring it to court? Like, say someone admits to a murder. They had to bring it to court?
The admission is not acceptable according to the Jewish law.
So they had to bring it to court?
It had to be brought to court.
He tells them, "I did it. I killed him."
Yeah, but for instance, let's say, "Yes, I killed him, but I wasn't warned." That's a
It has to be worn by two witnesses. Exactly, like two witnesses.
There are so many ways that he can get out of it for it. That, you know, it's easy to present some kind of a defense, at least that he shouldn't get death penalty, for instance. So therefore, it's so unlikely that there shouldn't be one person who says, listen, we can't pass a judgment of guilty. If we couldn't find one, that's it. It's out of the question. What the idea? The idea is like this, that the person who defends him can't be a person who is paid to say he's right. It doesn't make sense. How can you be paid to say you're right? It goes against the idea of justice. Justice is when you are convinced he's right. So it has to be one of the judges. See, that's the Jewish system vis-a-vis the secular system of law. Okay, in the Jewish system, the judge himself has to defend. Then there is another interesting law, the law Lo Takir Panim. That's the second one in verse number 19. Lo Takir Panim. Don't recognize a face. That's what it means literally. Don't recognize a face. I wonder how it's translated in the English. Lo Takir Panim. Don't recognize a face. Don't respect the person, which makes it even more difficult. What does it say?
It says don't give a special consideration.
Don't?
Give a special consideration.
Don't give a special consideration. Okay. It's good, but it's not wrong. I'm just telling you that the explanation is the following. The situation is, Rashi, the commentary here, brings it down. What about if the judge is a fair person, let's say, or the judges, or the head of the court, and A sitting here and B sitting here, right? But for some reason, the way he acts towards A is one way, the way he acts towards B is different. Towards A, he's very strict, and towards B, he's very nice, and he converses with him. Or another case, how about A? I know I'm the judge. I know A. I don't know B. And I say, hi, how are you? How's your family? What's wrong with that? I mean, a judge and my job, but what else do? We went fishing together, so why not? We are good friends. If I, at this point, say, hi, how are you, how is your family, how is your fishing going, at that moment, says Rashi, right, I'm not doing anything wrong, but Rashi says, that other poor person sitting over here says to himself, okay, that's it, that's the end. Even though he may be completely wrong, but what happens, says Rashi, his mouth closes. That's what Rashi's expression is. Right? The moment he sees that he acts differently to the other person, mistat min tanotav, he just can't talk anymore. It's a psychological idea. Meaning, not only does the judge have to be fair, it's not enough that he should be fair. They have to have a perception of fairness, which is something which is completely different. He still may be fair just because we went fishing together. You think that's going to affect my judgment? What do you think I am? You think that will make a difference? Of course not. But it doesn't matter. But the other poor person, he has a perception of unfairness. That's sufficient to make it prohibited. You hear? So not only do I have to make sure that I am fair, but I have to give the people the perception of fairness. Okay? That's something very, very important. Some people say that this follows the whole concept of marit ayin. In Judaism in general, there is a tremendous stress that not only should you do the right thing, but that people should perceive it as being right. Right? That there are many things that people who don't know Torah can say, well, that's hypocritical. Right? And Torah stresses, no, you must do it. Meaning, it's not enough that you should do something right. For instance, you have in the Shulchan Aruch, in our Book of Laws, don't drink almond milk, supposedly almond milk looks exactly like regular milk, together with meat. Even though it's absolutely okay. Almond milk is not milk. You're not allowed to drink milk and together with meat. Unless you put some almonds in front of you, right? The same halakha in the beginning when margarine, I don't know if you're aware of this, but in the beginning, when part of the, you know, non-dairy margarine came into the market,
It was very unusual. Many people didn't even know that there was such a thing as non-dairy margarine. First of all, it looks like butter, right? So many rabbis used to warn, you are not allowed to put margarine on the table if you are eating a meal with meat, because it looks like butter, unless you put the wrapper on the table. Right? In other words, because it's not enough that you should do the right thing. It has to be perceived as being right. Okay, there's something extremely important in Judaism, the idea of marit ayin, how it looks to the eye of the other person. Right? So some people say this is just consistent with this idea. It's not enough that the judge should be fair. He has to pass judgments that look fair, and then they are perceived as fair. Okay? This is what the Torah is warning. The next warning is lo tikach shokat. Don't take a bribe. Ki hashokat, because bribes ye aver einei chachamim, blind the eyes of the wise, v'salev divrei tzadikim, and twists the words of the righteous. That's what bribes do. Again, say the commentaries. What are we talking about? Are we talking about a case that you go to the judge and you say, here is $100, pass a judgment of innocence. Right? And that's what the judge does. I mean, obviously, that's not what we are talking about. Number one, because the Torah is talking to Chachamim and Tzadikim. It says that. Chachamim, great Talmidei Chachamim, very wise men, Tzadikim. So obviously we're not talking about the low human level. Right? We're talking about a very, very high human level. So therefore, what is the idea of bribing? So it says like this. Obviously we're not talking about a bribe that's given in order to affect the judgment. That's not the situation at all. It's not a bribe that was given in order to affect the judgment. We are talking about a situation when one of the parties that's taking part of the judgment does anything. It can be a word, a statement, that it's made in order to affect the judgment indirectly. How can it be such a thing? See, you find it, for instance, by lawyers very often. They would say like this, let's see now, you have a woman judge, you have to stand in front of a woman judge. Use some magic words, and if you use those magic words, you'll affect her judgment. Use the word mercy, or some magic word that affects this judge, right? If you are in front of some other judge, use other words that will affect him, right? What are you doing, really? You're bribing him. But of course, a much subtler way of bribing people. It's not money, here's $1,000, go my way, but it's a very subtle type of bribing people. This is why it says, ki hashochad, because the bribe, that type of a bribe, can affect even the most intelligent of people. Right? Now, you are not even aware that you are being bribed. This is what it says. Even a tzaddik and a chacham can be bribed if you know how to. So therefore, it's an obligation of the parties themselves that they are not allowed to use methods in order to bribe. And now, verse number 20. Tzedek, tzedek tirdo. And this is a verse that has many, many commentaries. Tzedek, righteous, or righteousness, righteousness tirdo you shall pursue. So the first question is, what does it mean? What is the meaning of the double expression? Number two, what is the meaning of the word tirdof, to pursue? What is the idea of pursuing something? So, one of the commentaries says that what it means is the following. What about if
you pass a wrong judgment for the right reason. Like, here is an example of the Talmud. The Talmud gives the following example. A poor person is in a case against a rich person. Right? And the judge sees that the poor person is losing. So, does the judge have a right to say like this? Now, if the poor person is going to lose, then the rich person is going to have to give him $100. For the rich person, that's absolutely... I'm sorry, if the poor person loses, the poor person will have to give the rich person $100. Obviously, he won't have anything to eat. So obviously, he's going to have to collect charity. Who is he going to go to? To the rich person, who probably will give him $100. Right? So, isn't it much easier? It must be much less embarrassing to the poor person if I just say that he is right and the rich person is wrong. Right? He'll keep his pride. He won't have to go collecting money for himself. And everything will come out fine. Says the Torah, you're not allowed to. Why? Because according to the Jewish law, the end doesn't justify the means. In other words, I can't pass the wrong judgment for the right reasons. Right? I can't take into consideration the consequences of the judgment. The judgment has to be the right one, no matter what the consequences are going to be. Okay? And really, this is an exception to the rule, because according to Torah, the rule is the end doesn't justify the means, but with one exception. Lying. You're allowed to lie for the right purpose. That's the only thing that you can do for the right purpose. You can't kill for the right purpose. You can't steal for the right purpose. You can't steal from the rich to give to the poor, for instance. Right? But you are allowed to twist the truth for the right purpose. Says the Talmud, for instance. You are allowed, for instance, to say, you know, the case in the Talmud, the man, your friend that marries an ugly girl, and he asks you, what do you think of her? Can you say she's ugly? No, say she's beautiful, even though you're lying, because your obligation is not to hurt her. Here is the example of the ends justifying the means, but that's the exception to the rule. Right? And the commentaries say, where is it hinted in the Torah that lying is the exception to the rule? It says like this. Every other commandment, every other negative commandment is described straightforward in the Torah. You shall not do this, you shall not do that. About lying, it says in the Torah, Midvar sheker tircha, keep away from lies. What is the difference between keep away from lies or don't lie? Keep away from lies means keep away as much as possible. But if it's impossible, go ahead. Twist the truth for the right purpose, you can do it. Don't abuse it, but you can do it. But there is an exception in the exception. In a court of law. The court of law is a place of truth. Therefore, even though all the judge would be doing is lying, he's not allowed to do it, because that's the place of truth. You know, it's in a court of law, you can't justify your statement because it's for the right purpose. You can't do it. You have to say the right thing. But outside of a court of law, you are allowed to twist the truth for the right purpose. The Gemara says, Talmud says, Mishum Shalom Bayit. Let's say the wife asks you about, did you see my husband here, right, for instance? And you know that if you say the truth, it will destroy the marriage. Lie, it says. Right? Say a non-truth. Right? Of course, you have to minimize it as little as possible. Same thing we find, for instance, in the Torah itself. Remember, there's a whole story of Abraham. In order, of course, that was to save his life. Right? That he says, say that you are my sister. Remember, with Sarah. Right? Or Jacob, tricking his father that he is Esau.
Sarah and Abraham, she said, you know, she's going to give birth to her child. She said, how? She laughed. She said, my husband is old. So when Hashem relates it to Abraham, he says, no, Sarah said she was old.
Vadoniza came, Sarah says, right? Vaniza kanti, right? That's how we learn out that you're allowed to twist the truth, right? In order to maintain something, not to destroy a marriage, for instance. So this is why it says here, in a court of law, It has to be tzedek with tzedek, double tzedek. Now, you can't just look for justice even though I'm going to twist justice. No, no. In a court of law, it has to be justice with justice. It can't be justice without justice. Okay, this is what it means. Now, the word here, dope, of course, it says like this. In a Mishnah, in Pirkei Avot, it says like this. Hillel Omer, Hillel says, you shall be, it's advice that he's giving you, you shall be like the disciples of Aaron. Ohev Shalom, he loves peace. Verode, pursues peace. This is what it means to pursue peace. So many commentaries say that what it means is the following. What does it mean to pursue peace? That he goes beyond his obligation. Literally. What does it mean? For instance, when Aaron used to see two people fighting, he would go to one and say, how come you're keeping a grudge against the other person? I mean, he feels badly about it. So how about changing your mind? Then he would go to the first person and say exactly the same thing. And when they would meet each other, right, they would be friends again. And this is how the Talmud describes the word Rodev Shalom. He pursues it. Because if you just like it, you wouldn't go to that extent, right? Meaning, it's going to an extreme. Now, on the surface, this is exactly what we are saying. You are not allowed to do in a court. You are not allowed to lie for the right purpose. And the way the Talmud describes what Aaron was doing is that he was lying, right? Doesn't it sound like that? He would go to A, he would say, don't keep a grudge against B. B feels very badly. Right? But in reality, the commentaries, it says like this, that it's based on a certain statement about Aaron, that Aaron lo shina, he never changed the truth. That's why he was worthy of lighting the menorah. Menorah is the symbol of truth. Light and truth have a very strong connection with each other. Light and truth, right? So the menorah is the symbol of truth, emet, right? Who used to light the menorah? The Kohanim, the priest, Aaron. When he was alive, he would do it. Why? Because he was a man of truth. Right? Shelo Shina. So the commentaries say, isn't it a contradiction? How can you say that Aaron never lied? According to how the Talmud describes his search for peace, it involved lying. Remember, he would go to A and say, B feels very badly for you. And vice versa. So the commentaries say like this. No, what it really means is, and that's a continuation of the statement, Aaron loved human beings. He had a love for humanity. Now, we know that feelings by human beings are not pure. Most of the times it's a mixture. So let's say you're in a fight with somebody. So you're angry at him. But really, if you quantify that anger, you can't say that it's 100% anger. Maybe if you're very, it's a 90% anger. You never reach 100%. But if you would reach 100%, you would be completely a corrupt human being. There must be a little bit of humanity left in you that understands the other person's position and you don't hate him. Which means even your hatred for something that the other person did to you, is mixed with a certain feeling of understanding and sympathy for the other person's position. Now, when Aaron would say, you know, A, don't be so angry at B, because he feels very badly that you are angry at him. It's not that Aaron was lying. Aaron actually sensed those positive feelings mixed in the mostly negative feelings. That's how sensitive Aaron was to the human nature. Okay? So it doesn't mean that Aaron was lying. It means that Aaron was super sensitive to positive emotions in human beings. So when he would say to Reuven, right, to A, Simon feels very badly, he was actually bringing out actual feelings by Simon, that he actually does feel very badly, but he doesn't even realize, because those positive feelings are being drowned out by the very negative feelings of his anger. Of the superficial emotions that are being shown, right? That you are aware of things that maybe the people themselves aren't aware of. That is the redifa, the pursuing. So this is what it says. Tzedek tirdo doesn't just mean following the book. Yes, cases like this, you have to sense the subtleties of tzedek, of righteousness. The way Aaron, right? That's how he's described, that he sensed the subtleties of human emotions and is described as pursuing the well-being of human beings. The pursuing of justice, of righteousness, demands a sixth sense in order to be aware exactly of the subtleties of the case that somebody on the surface will not be aware of. This is why the Torah uses the word tirdo. And then it says, Lemantichye, in order you shall live the Orashtu Esaurus, in order that you should be able to live in the land Asher Hashem Elokecha, no Teila. In order that you should be able to live on the land that God gives you, no Teila. What does it mean, no Teila, that God gives you? It means that as long, say, this is the Talmudic statement, as long as you keep judging correctly, you keep deserving the land. The moment you start judging incorrectly, you lose your right over the land of Israel. In other words, what the Torah is doing now is making the Jews' right over the land of Israel conditional on the correct judgment. In other words, as long as tzedek tirdo, as long as you will develop a tremendous sensitivity to justice, then the Mantichieva Rashis Aurich will be able to take over the land and live with it. In it, right? Because you know that the relationship of Jews to the land of Israel, we believe, is drastically different than any other nation's relationship to their land, right? I mean, an Italian is an Italian is an Italian, that's all. Our relationship to the land of Israel is that we have to deserve it. Meaning, it's a privilege. If we deserve it, we have it. The moment we don't deserve it, we are taken away from the land. We are separated from the land of Israel. Now, the land of Israel is sensitive to injustice. Okay? This is why the commentaries say, after the flood, right, we don't, where's the first case after the flood that God reacts to injustice and destroys city because of the injustices? Sodom and Gomorrah. Right? And then there were more of the four cities that were destroyed. Again, it's in Israel, that's what it says. Because it's hard to believe that it never happened before. I mean, there weren't other cities that were completely corrupt. They had a monopoly on corruption. So the commentaries say, yes, in Israel, those were the cities that were corrupted. The land of Israel is too sensitive to injustices, right? It can, they can take it for a certain amount of generations, and then the land of Israel just rejects them and throws them out. That's what it says concerning Sodom and Amorah. It's interesting. In the Torah it says that there was there are four cities that were destroyed. Sodom, Amorah, and the not well known Adma and Sfaim. There are four cities. But there was a fifth city that was supposed to be destroyed. And one of the reasons why God decided not to destroy it, it says, is because it was the youngest one. So God gave it more time. It was still corrupt, it was the youngest. In other words, after a certain amount of generations, the land of Israel can't take it anymore. Since Tsoar, this first, fifth city, was too young, so God allowed it to exist a little bit longer. Right? This is what he says over here. You want to have the guarantee that you're going to stay in the land of Israel? Keep justice. Tzedek, tzedek, tzedek. You don't? The land of Israel won't be able to digest you. They won't be able to keep you anymore. Okay, we'll continue.